Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show, including how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake and Reframe. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Pub Talk Live. Jennifer, I'm acknowledging that you were here before the show started. Thank you for showing up. Hey, Jay. Hey, Lone Star. So we have a great show for you today. I have Cindy Etler is going to be my guest co-host and Jane Friedman is going to be my special guest. So I'm super excited for our chat tonight. I'm your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, a board member and agent liaison for Pitch Wars and a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss a show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. So I'm going to go ahead and bring on my guest co-host. Cindy Etler is a modern day Cinderella. She was homeless at 13, locked up at 14, suicidal at 15, and summa cum laude at 30. Today, she's a teen life coach and the award-winning author of two YA memoirs. She's been featured on CNN, NPR, The Doctors, ABC, HuffPost, and other media outlets, and now she's here. She lives with her husband and dogs in North Carolina. So please welcome Cindy to the show.
Hi, happy to be here.
Hello, I'm so glad you're here. All right. So let's see. We have a couple of people saying hi in the comments. Are you all right?
Yeah. Hi, guys. Yeah.
So the regulars that watch my show, they named themselves Pubbers about a year ago. And so if you see people saying hi, Pubbers, yeah, that's my little show following.
Nice.
All right, so I just wanted to, I just almost accidentally clicked on something. That would have been bad. So I just wanted to make sure y'all voted in this week's viewer poll. This one is specifically for writers today. And so I'm dropping the link in the chat as soon as it's having some connection issues. There it is. Okay, so make sure you go ahead and vote on that. And the question is, have you participated in a Twitter book pitch event like PitMed? Savannah said I was waiting for this live stream while I was writing, and I have a very scary moment of where is the sound coming from. I've done that before. All right, so if this is your first time watching the show, we do a little bit of publishing news and then we do an interview. So we're going to jump right into the publishing news. This is something that was like of personal interest to me. I don't know if anyone else will care, but I mean, I'm sure some people will care. The Enola Holmes series has a new publisher. Nancy Springer, who's the author, sold North American rights to new books in her series to Wednesday Books, an imprint of St. Martin's, which is super fun because there was a Netflix series, in case you missed it. It's cool that there are going to be new books out now.
All right. And you guys have probably heard at least some of this, but literary agent Brooks Sherman is no longer working at Gianclo and Nesbitt, the agency he's worked at since 2017. He was also dropped by many clients, including Angie Thomas. These events come on the heels of a number of allegations against Sherman, including some posted anonymously to Query Tracker. I would love to know what you think about this.
Well, this was big news in publishing. A lot of people were talking about it on Twitter. A lot of people were subtweeting about it on Twitter. And I don't know because it's hard to say because I haven't seen any like specific allegations, right? Yeah. And I haven't seen any that weren't someone saying someone told them this. And so it's hard, but I can't imagine because I've had some conversations with Angie Thomas in the past and which when Pitch Wars has what people call fee gate, she was like supportive of Pitch Wars and even though we acknowledge that was a bad decision, like she was supportive of it. And so I just can't imagine Angie Thomas, you know, leaving him without having some sort of information. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I was looking for the same. I was looking for the concrete details and I saw like moving ocean waves and it left me confused, but you make an excellent point. Yeah.
Yeah. But Yeah, so there was a lot of conversation about that online on Twitter last week, a lot of conversation about agents and the trust that writers put in them and what makes a good agent and how sometimes an agent at the beginning of your career who is good for that might not be an agent who's great for the, you know, the middle of your career, that kind of thing. So, yeah, though it is interesting to think about, like, when someone like Angie Thomas leaves their agent so publicly,
yeah.
All the agents, like, apparently were contacting her, of course, yes. Which makes sense, you know?
Yes. Is there an update on, I mean, she obviously hasn't, like, given her rose to a suitor yet.
I haven't seen anything. Yeah, a lot of people were comparing it to The Bachelor,
which is
great. Yeah, which is just, I mean, she's so great and she's such a great writer and she's so supportive of the writing community. So I love to see her success no matter, but it is, I can imagine going through something like that that's usually handled pretty privately, being so public could be stressful, you know?
Right. On the flip, putting myself in her shoes, she's in the catbird seat. She has no worries. She can pick. She is the pick of the litter. So she's in a power position, which I love for her. It's not her, you know, maybe she does have a problem on her hands, but in this case, it seems like she can choose. She's not going to suffer in this, I hope.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll move on from that. So this is some happy news. Rick Riordan's imprint, which has been publishing wonderful, magical, middle grade books for 3 years now, is expanding into young adult books. Daniel Jose Older, who is wrote, you know, some of my favorite books, Shadow Shaper series, will write the first YA book published by the imprint. The first novel, Ballad and Danger, will come out in May 2022. Yes, Uncle Rick is moving into YA. So super excited for that.
Sweet. And we finally have a mostly complete picture of traditional book sales from last year. No one will be surprised by this. Overall sales are pretty flat, with trade adult and kid lit sales up, but educational materials down. And also, this seems very logical. Downloadable audiobooks saw an increase of over 15%. Relatedly, bookstore sales are down 28.3% in 2020 versus 2019. What I thought was really interesting when I looked at that data was that there was a small spike in, like, February or March. And then in April, there was a huge drop. And if you look at that through the lens of the cultural temperature and the cultural mood, big drop in April. Then it was, you know, 30%, 35%. And then over the last few months, it's edged up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of take the temperature of everybody's mood via the book sales status in bookstores.
Well, I think also part of it is so much closed down, like late March, April, and a lot of bookstores weren't ready, right? And so a lot of them had trouble like transitioning to a not in store model, whatever that looked like for them. Yeah. But this is a good time to mention that all of the news items that we talk about at the end of the show, I put the links for them in the description. So you can go and read more about them. And this is actually two articles from Publishers Weekly that have a whole bunch of stats on them. So if you're really interested in doing a deep dive on that, you can go check those out for sure. And if you're listening on a replay, they're already there. And if you're listening on the podcast version, they're already there too. So, yeah. So bookstore sales are down. Not terribly surprising over the year, but we'll see what happens, I guess. So we talked a couple shows ago about Higgins Berman filing a price-fixing lawsuit against Amazon last month. Since then, they have added the Big Five publishers as defendants, which was kind of what we talked about on the show when we talked about it. And three similar suits have been filed by other parties, prompting the plaintiffs to request a consolidation of the four cases. So basically, we're just waiting. I mean, lawsuits are very long game. And so we'll keep you updated if anything interesting happens on the show. But yeah, so this has become a bigger lawsuit.
Yeah, which, that's a big, yeah.
Which happens a lot. Like if a lawsuit like this is filed, it's there's often, they call them copycat. I don't like the term, but they're like copycat lawsuits that are similar, you know? So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a big one. Keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, in sort of the fluff category, not fluff, but cool and spicy, I think, book subscription box Literati pulled in a whopping $52 million in financing recently. The company, it was founded in 2017. And what they do is they ship children's books in a model that resembles closed subscription services. So parents can return or purchase the books once receiving them. They also have book clubs for adult readers. Literati seeks to expand its data collection and algorithms, but also plans to use the money to become a motivational, aspirational platform that encourages people to read more. And I mean, if you click the link, it's, I was excited reading about it. I was like, oh, I can really see this. I mean, it was sort of for parents, it's the idea you're overwhelmed by options. And here's somebody who takes stock of what you're interested or what your kid is interested in and then curates. They use that wonderful word, curates the selections. And they don't only send books. They send you a letter and then they send you some little gewgaws. And I was like, I don't have a kid, but I want a kid to get this book.
Yeah, well, because it's interesting to me because I'm mainly familiar with book boxes for like young adult and fantasy. And so it's like they send you the book and that's what it is. Like you pay for the book and other things and you keep the book. So I was interested in that model where like you can decide to keep or return it. But then also $52 million for a book subscription box service.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah. Well, one of these guys, one of your pubbers posted, oh, I'm surprised educational book sales are down. As a former teacher who's really tuned into what's happening in education during COVID, I'm like, nobody wants education, but people still want fun and people still want reading. Mm-hmm. So this makes a lot of sense to me in terms of just that, what's happening in education in the country.
Well, it's also, it's important to note that like we say trade kidlit, that includes like kind of the popular kidlit nonfiction, right? Mm. Which I think is what parents were more interested in and getting for their kids rather than the educational, which is like textbooks, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see what they do with $52 million.
They had the right idea at the right time.
I wonder, it's like, they're a little vague about this motivational, aspirational platform. But I wonder if it's going to be maybe some sort of alternative to Goodreads. You know what I mean?
Ooh.
I don't know. I have no idea what they're doing. That's just me guessing.
Do we see confetti flying in the air from all authors at the mere thought of a redo of Goodreads? Yeah. Somebody, please. I like it. I hope you're right.
Yeah. In some more fun news, Reese's Book Club is launching Eat the Book, a four-part series hosted by Christina Milian that will feature popular Reese's Book Club authors and female chefs to bring to life moments from the featured books through cooking a dish. And if any of you follow me on Instagram, you know that this is very much my thing.
Wow. What do you think about this?
I think it's interesting. I don't think it's not a new idea. Like I've seen people do similar things, you know, but Reese Witherspoon, Reese's Book Club has a huge reach. And so it's interesting to me. I love food. So
do you know? Sorry, keep going.
No. Yes, Christina Milian, the singer and actress. She's done several Christmas romance movies, of which I have seen all of them.
I love the concept. It's taking the book and bringing it to the kitchen. It's making it three-dimensional. I just love it. Maybe I live in a cave, but this to me seems like novelty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say something before they asked Christina Milian, the singer. This is like, maybe it's the pandemic, but I've been really relishing this kind of like comfort TV, you know, like Nadia from Great British Bake Off, like her show is just so relaxing and so calm. And so I'm really hoping it's just like something like that, but then there's also books involved.
Yes. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Well, speaking of books and wonder and change, We Need Diverse Books is launching a new series of programs called the Black Creatives Fund. There will be a workshop on revisions, a mentoring program, and a symposium on marketing and brand building. Past Pub Talk Live guest Danielle Clayton will oversee the initiative. So when I looked into that, what I read was that when Black authors, what happens frequently is when Black authors submit their books, this is a great book, this is a great concept, but the snag comes with revisions, which is time consuming. I can say that for sure. I guess I can't comment too much more on what happens there, but that seems to be, that's the snag. And so this initiative is designed to provide access specifically to what it is that editors and agents are looking for and polishing, and then learning the insider stuff on the industry, which, how do you get access to that? Well, We Need Diverse Books initiative is striving to provide that. So this is killer.
Yeah, it sounds really cool. And it sounds extensive too, because like a lot of times you'll get pieces of this. So you can get like a mentorship, or you can get classes on marketing and brand building, but to have it all together in one program is, I think, really the big difference here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ebony, we are fans of Danielle on this show.
Yes. Yes. And there's a lot of talk about, well, get a mentor. Yeah, well, how? I mean, how do you just find somebody who has the time, knowledge, and generosity to take you under their wing? That's a needle in a haystack thing. This is a whole initiative. People can apply and get it and get that whole package. So that's just some beautiful progress as far as I'm concerned.
All right. So we are ready to bring on Jane. So Jane Friedman has 20 years of experience in the publishing industry with expertise in business strategy for authors and publishers. She's the editor of The Hot Sheet, the essential industry newsletter for authors. It's great. Y'all should subscribe. And has previously worked for FNW Media and the Virginia Quarterly Review. In 2019, Jane was awarded Publishing Commentator of the Year by Digital Book World, and her newsletter was awarded Media Outlet of the Year in 2020. So please welcome to the show, Jane Friedman.
Hello.
Hi. I'm so glad you could join us today. I gotta admit, I was like nervous to ask you to be on the show, and you agreed, and I was so happy. So
I'm so glad you asked me. I admire your newsletter and
oh, thank you.
Everything that you do. So thank you.
Thank you.
Gosh. Coming from Jane admires something about you. Like, do you need a fainting couch?
I was just gonna like take that clip and like save it on my phone for whenever I need motivation.
Bigly. All right. So Jane, can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory? How did you go from working for publishing institutions to where you are now? And was it an intentional shift for you?
I almost got fired. That's how I became a freelancer.
Nice.
Yeah. So it wasn't, I was pushed. I mean, that's a great story to tell. I don't know if this is the right venue for that story, but I worked at a literary journal. I moved several states away from my home to work at this journal, and it didn't last very long. And I realized if I didn't leave, I was going to get fired. So I resigned gracefully and gave myself 2 months to try and figure out a freelance plan. But I mean, fortunately, I've always been interested in digital media, in social media. I already had a website. I already had an email newsletter. So it wasn't like this really scary jump off the cliff. It was just a sort of scary jump off the high dive. I don't know. It wasn't a terrible landing. It went pretty well.
Wow. I think my favorite thing about you is the contrast between your persona, which is hats off, big wonk nerd, and the fact that you were gonna get fired. You know, it's like there's a secret Britney in there somewhere, Jane Friedman. I don't know. So you carry so much, you wear so many hats. What resources do you use to stay ahead of and on top of the constantly changing literary world trends and movement?
Well, some of it is I've been in the industry so dang long at this point that I feel like I know where to go for the information I need, even if it's not available. So mm-hmm. I've been working in publishing since the late 90s, and I have to give a big shout out, not that he cares at all, to Michael Cater of Publisher's Lunch, because I've been subscribing to his newsletter since it started practically. And even though I didn't understand it at first, it was just through, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 years of reading his newsletter, understanding how publishing works. He's very astute in looking at how the major media covers publishing. Ooh. So that was like the first major piece of the puzzle of my industry education. Mm-hmm. Today, I'm still a subscriber, of course, but I subscribe to maybe 30 or 40 different wow. newsletters, publications, databases. I have a pretty finely curated Twitter feed. I joined Twitter in 2008, 2009, so I've been on it a long time. I'm on a lot of different Facebook groups, you know, binders groups and self-publishing author groups. I keep an eye on certain chat or message boards like Kindle boards. So, you know, I have a lot of different sources. And then I also have, because I've been around so long, there are people who just come to me with information and they say, have you heard X? And going back to the Brooke Sherman thing, I definitely saw what was happening on Twitter. It was kind of hard to miss if you're in writing and publishing. Mm-hmm. But I also, because I meet with a lot of authors, even during the pandemic, you know, I'm consulting with authors virtually. And I had a client who was repped by him. And, you know, she was, her reason for consulting with me was, in fact, I can't get the time of day from my agent. But, you know, I didn't take that as unusual. That happens to authors all the time.
Yeah, I do hear that story a lot.
But I did counsel her, you know, here are the steps you take. Here's how to try to get his attention. And then if you can't, it's time to leave. So anyway, bottom line, I have lots of different sources at this point, and it's by the grace of having been in the industry as long as I have.
So some of it is just way back when, and you've been absorbing all this information like fly tape since like the BC era. Okay, got it. But there's all this current intake, 40 subscriptions you have, all these different groups. So can you tell us your secret? Like, what does your work day look like? Like, really? What time do you wake up? And what is the setting you work in? And do you adhere to a strict schedule? You know, help us like step into your shoes or slippers.
So- Yeah. I'm a late sleeper. So I don't usually roll out of bed until 8:30 or 9 o'clock. I have a leisurely breakfast. So I normally sit at my desk by, I don't know, 10 o'clock. But you know, that I've designed my days like that. I think you too can design your days to accommodate a 10 a.m. start time. So at that point, you know, I have certain tasks that I've scheduled myself that have to get done that day, maybe two or three things. It could be client work. It could be something I need to write. And so I usually focus on getting those done first before something else in the day overtakes me. And then I may have client appointments in the afternoon. I try to keep them, like, let's say from 12 to 4 o'clock. There's a break for lunch. And a lot of the later part of the day is just for email triage, dealing with things that I see coming in, responding to people. And there's also social in there. You know, I'm checking social both for to keep up with stuff I need to write about, to understand what's happening in the industry, as I've discussed. And also just for a break, it's like having the radio on in the background.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah.
I did want to mention, so the question about like the, what, you know, what resources do you use to stay on top of things, that actually came from Bess, who is a longtime, watcher of the show, and she hosts my Wednesday write-ins with me. And I was having a, quite a busy day yesterday. And, I had three events today, and then I'm hosting an event tomorrow with Carla Hayden. So, I'm very nervous about that. Yeah. But she's like, what can I do? And I said, do you have any questions? Like, can you help me come up with questions for Jane? And she came up with that question. I was like, oh, that's really good. I want to know that too.
Yeah.
Well, if it's interesting, I can mention some specifics. Sometimes
it
gets boring for folks. But I mean, some of the other major newsletters and publications, I think you would be aware of at least, Sarah, mm-hmm. like Publishers Weekly, obviously. Mm-hmm. There's Shelf Awareness for the bookseller community. Yeah. I also look at some of the international organizations or publications like the Bookseller in the UK. There's the Quill Inquirer in Canada. And then there's a lot of what I would call kind of book publishing adjacent newsletters that cover journalism and often talk about books and other issues that are relevant to writers. There's so many of them, like, you know, they're mm-hmm. the Axios newsletters that cover the media. There's the Bo Sachs newsletter, which I've been subscribing to since 2000. It's been around that long. And you know, things that are more about digital media tools as well, like Product Hunt. So you can just kind of stay on top of where the conversation is in different sectors, because eventually it affects book publishing. You know, it affects book deals, it affects what mm-hmm. agents are interested in. So book publishing is a cultural industry. So having a little bit of a broad base of intake, I think, is helpful.
Yeah.
And so we just can subscribe to the hot sheet to take all of that and put it down the big corn funnel thing
there
and just
go. Let
the individual kernels, the hot sheet. Hot sheet indeed.
All right. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you could subscribe to the free trial of Hot Sheet, get your mm-hmm. two issues, look through links of interest, and there's your cheat sheet for all the stuff I look at.
Yeah. Nice.
This seems like a lot of work, though.
You do the work. We'll get the hot sheet.
All right. So Patreon supporters at $5 or more a month can submit questions ahead of time for our guests. And so this is a question from Lodestar, who I believe is here today. Yeah, he is here. Mm-hmm. Since you worked at UVA for the Virginia Quarterly Review, did you ever work with the students in Creative Writing MFA program and Meridian?
I did not. This was one of the weird experiences of being at that journal. First off, it wasn't located on grounds.
Oh.
And they don't call it campus. They call it grounds. So we were about, 2 miles out of town. So that made it actually kind of difficult to collaborate with the rest of the community, unless we were going to go into town or they were going to come out to us.
Yeah.
And then I don't know quite how to describe its operation. It was almost like a satellite of the university rather than closely involved with it, which seemed a shame. And I think there was also this this hesitation to have too close a relationship with the English department or the creative writing department, because it didn't want to be seen as an outlet for the professors of the university. It was supposed to be a world-class publication, you know, and we weren't going to publish just the people in our backyard. So I think that was probably playing a role. So I'm sorry to say I can't share any tidbits on that.
Cool. Okay. So no scuttlebutt on that. How about this? On your website, you talk about how indie authors tend to see you as a traditional establishment figure.
Yes.
And meanwhile, the publishing establishment sees you as an indie figure. How do you define yourself and your brand?
Well, in that bio, I call myself a bridge. And
perfect.
I like looking at the 360 degree view of the industry. I tend to think that authors have more in common than they have differences. The sorts of issues that affect them are probably going to affect all of them, not just one side or the other. Although there are some important differences. When I was at Writer's Digest, the magazine, the book line, when I began as a managing editor, I was assigned the self-publishing beat. This was back when you actually had beats. And so I was assigned to read like the self-publishing manual by Dan Pointer, who's like the godfather of self-publishing. And, you know, all of the guides at that time were really focused on a lot of the work that was involved in self-publishing, because this was really before print on demand took off. It was before the Kindle, certainly long before ebooks became what they are today. And it was also really kind of before Amazon took off as well. So it was just a very different environment. And there was a stigma, like I was kind of low man on the totem pole at Writer's Digest because I was the one who did the self-publishing crap. And so as I, you know, made my way at Writer's Digest and in my publishing career, I continued to have kind of that soft spot for self-publishing. And I felt like it was innovative and the people doing it were courageous. And it just so happened that self-publishing took off not that long after I started at Writer's Digest. So I think it's become, it's another path that you can choose. It's neither better nor lesser than. So I find myself, like if I'm at a self-publishing conference, which I go to a number that are focused in that manner, I find myself having to defend the merit why you would in fact choose traditional publishing. It's very tribal. And so I'm a bit of a contrarian, which is why I almost got fired. So whichever environment I'm in, I'm going to push back against whatever I think the established belief system is. Are you sure you think this? Why do you think that way? Why are you knocking this other thing? Have you tried it?
I love that. I teach, because I self-publish and I also traditionally publish, and people are surprised because I'm so associated with Pitch Wars, they associate with me in traditional publishing. And a lot of times when people ask me for, you know, resources or where to learn about, you know, different things, a lot of times I'll recommend indie publishing sites, especially because they just cover marketing and publicity so much more extensively, right? And so I teach this workshop, like choosing your publishing path, like what factors you need to consider. And people come all the time thinking I'm going to tell them what's the better thing, right? And they're surprised to find out, like, oh, I think any path could work for anyone, or not anyone, but you know, depending on what your goals are and what you plan to do. So yeah, I definitely have experienced that before, where you're trying to convince self-publishing crowd that traditional publishing isn't all, you know, scam artists and vice versa. And so it's great that you said that.
And bless you for, you know, having an even message yourself. I mean, it always kind of makes my blood boil when people on either side come out and say, well, you know, I don't know why anyone would do X. And it's just like,
that's actually where that workshop came from, because I had been to a couple different like panels and workshops where I did feel like it was one-sided one way or the other. The people representing different paths gave not great information, misleading information maybe. And so that's part of why I developed the workshop, is I was like, there needs to be something that's not like, this is the right thing to do, you know? Like, here are your options. Here are the challenges involved. Here are the benefits involved. And you need to decide what's right for you, which I think is so important in publishing anyway.
I think it's amazing that you are currently doing both traditional and self-published. That kind of clears it up. I started as self-published, and then I was like the chupacabra. I got a traditional publisher and I got an agent, but for the haters of the traditional publishing crowd, my agent, contrary to Jane's client, she'll answer me on a Sunday for my emails, and it's not like I'm her top client. She's just is there for me, and my publisher responds to every email, unlike some of my friends who are authors. So I'm having a great experience in both worlds. But I feel like this is kind of a rare this is a rare bird.
Cindy, I'm super excited for your next question.
Aha, this is, I think, the really big one. All right, Jane, what do you think are some of the biggest publishing challenges and advancements that authors should keep their eye on as they plan their careers?
Well, I mean, Amazon has to enter the conversation at some point. because it just dominates everything, at least in the United States. I realize it might be different for anyone listening in Europe or Asia. But at least for us Anglophone folks, it's hard to think about the future of publishing without what happens to Amazon and what are its next moves. But moving beyond what Amazon does or doesn't do, I'm really fascinated by the future of subscription. And that includes ebook and audiobook subscription, because we're seeing two models emerge. There's the a la carte pay model, at least for audiobooks, like through Audible. You know, you buy your credit, you pay your monthly fee and you get your credit. So it's kind of like, you know, publishers get to sell audiobooks one by one through that method and earn a lot of money. Mm. But in Europe, there's a different model that's become predominant through a company called Storytel, which is an all-you-can-eat subscription model, like the Kindle Unlimited model in the US, if you're familiar with that, for ebooks. So, you know, publishers get paid based on, you know, the time of consumption rather than a la carte, you were going to pay you this set fee for this audiobook. So Storytel is growing phenomenally. Like, they keep beating every quarterly forecast. And when Amazon launched their latest iteration of the Audible store, which I believe was in Spain, they had to have as more of a Storytel model rather than the model that they have here in the US and the UK. So the other interesting thing is that the big publishers, Penguin Random House, namely, pulled out all of its titles from Storytel and similar subscription services for audio. Scribd also does audiobook subscription. They pulled their titles from Scribd in the US because they feel like it threatens the profitability of their sales. But I think if you look at the broader cultural consumer trends, especially for young people, you know, we're so accustomed to subscription services where you get to consume all you want and you're not getting, you know, you're not getting having this piecemeal approach. You're not getting things that are off the table. I mean, I know there are certain things you can't get through streaming, but by and large, you consume all you want and you can expect to get access to most of what you want. So there's this question of whether publishers will get left behind, or if people will choose other entertainment options, or if they, you know, what's going to happen if publishers don't get on board with some of these all-you-can-eat subscription services. That, to me, is a really fascinating challenge for the industry. In Europe, to go back to them, what's really, I think, kind of cool is that in Sweden, publishers are seeing more than half their income come out of companies like Storytel. And the authors in Norway are like begging their publishers to get all of their backlist into these services, because they find that they're very backlist driven consumption services. Mm-hmm. And so they see their income skyrocket when their publisher gets their full catalog in these subscription services. Because once you find an author you like, you go back to all of their backlist titles. And so there's more money coming in for these authors than they've seen before. And this is particularly true of fiction. Yeah. So anyway, I've gone on too long, I think, already about that, but that's what I've got my eye on.
Well, it made me think about the way we consume movies, where they'll release for a limited amount of time where you have to pay to see that specific movie. Yes. And then after a couple months or whatever, then they're usually on a streaming service.
Absolutely. So I think that would be brilliant, I think, for publishers to adopt that kind of windowing where, okay, if you do want Obama's latest memoir and you want to read it or listen to it in the first few months, yeah, you're going to have to pay a la carte. But then it moves into subscription. Hmm. I feel like that has to be coming, but not yet. It's not here.
Yeah. All right. So I'm sure everyone is asking you this, but I'd love to give your take on it. What do you think the long-term ramifications of the pandemic are going to be for the publishing industry?
Well, I think the direct-to-consumer emphasis that, you know, everyone has, publishers and authors have likely experienced, I think that's going to continue. Like, the the dramatic need for publishers to up their game in terms of reaching readers directly, whether that's through email or social media or some other method. It's just really super important. That's not to say that the bookstores aren't important, but I think the publishers that have managed to do particularly well during the pandemic, regardless of their size, are the ones who could reach out to readers. In fact, I just ran a piece in Hot Sheet about this, where if you look at even the small publishers, that they, some of them outperformed their 2019 figures. And it was because they either were in the right categories to begin with, like cocktails, or, you know, coloring books or kids materials, or they just had really good reach to their audiences without having to rely on retailers. So I think all publishers recognize that this is something they need to really, they need to amplify their reach or be more serious about. Also, the big five have to think about that so they aren't overly reliant on Amazon, which also grew tremendously because of the pandemic and probably only grew in terms of their footprint. The ones that are suffering the most because of the pandemic, and we may not see them come back like they once were, is maybe some of the independent booksellers. But still, even there, I think you're seeing a really a diversity of performance there. On average, you know, I think you guys mentioned booksellers are down for 2020 by about 30%, but some outperformed, some did about the same, and then some declined. And I bet you that the ones who declined just didn't find a way to meet demand through online. They weren't able to put that together, the systems or processes to do that, or they didn't, they weren't willing. So yeah, I think online ordering, direct to consumer, it speeded up, or it sped up changes that were kind of already in progress to some extent. I don't know that it's going to dramatically change the fortunes of the publishing industry. But I do think it's making publishers and authors aware of the need to reach readers direct.
Okay. Well, now we're going to take a big jump away from COVID and isolation and ask you a question from Patreon supporter Lodestar. What inspired you to travel to Burma for 2 weeks?
Oh, wow. That's someone who's been following me. Well, no, actually, I just posted on Instagram about it. So
It's in your long form bio too.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Things I forget. Okay, so I went to Burma for 2 weeks in 2015, and it was partly inspired by working at the literary journal at the Virginia Quarterly Review, where we had an issue devoted to what was happening in Burma. So at the time that that issue came out, there was a lot of hope and optimism because it appeared that the military dictatorship was, you know, loosening up a little, that there was going to be a democratic government, which did come to pass. But unfortunately, within the last month, it looks like the military is stepping back up, unfortunately. So I would, you know, that feature package that we did just made me super curious. I had already been to Thailand about 5 years prior, or six, 7 years prior, and it was just an amazing experience. And Burma is just next door. And they're both majority Buddhist countries with lots of temples and just practices that are so different from here. Like, you know, the monks, their tradition is to go out early in the morning and get their food, beg for alms from the people that, I mean, they rely totally on their communities to support them. And just to watch that, some of those practices are incredibly humbling. So we went to, my husband and I went to three different places. We went to Bagan, which is where there's this really tight concentration of Buddhist temples that were built by some guy who just went nuts and there's like so many, there's, I don't know how many hundreds there are. It might even be in the thousands, but you can just go from temple to temple. Most of them are, you know, in disrepair of various sorts of disrepair, but you can climb on top of them and go inside, and they're, I don't know, about 1,000 years old. You would never be able to do that anywhere in the Western world. And then we went to Inlay Lake, which is the people live on the lake in houses on stilts, traveled by boat. So yeah, it was, I don't know that there was much of an impetus behind the trip other than curiosity and a desire to see something that wasn't my ordinary life.
Cool.
Very cool. So you were initially inspired by that, your magazine though. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So just we have a question from the comments. I thought you might, I don't know if you have any on the top of your head. Do you have any workshops or places you'd recommend as resources for historical fiction writers?
I do. In fact, I'm speaking at a conference virtually in June. I think it's still in June. It's the, am I going to get their name exactly right? Hold on. Let me.
You are. You're Jane Friedman.
I'm going to bring it up just so I don't foul it up here. It's the Historical Novel Society, and it's meeting from June 24th to 26th. I happen to be offering a masterclass on publishing as part of that event. But it's a, now I've been working with them on the speaking engagement for, longer than a year, and they've had to change how they're presenting the event. It was supposed to be in San Antonio, I believe, in person. So I've been really impressed with the organization. I haven't spoken at this event before, but I already knew some of the people who are on the board, and I already know some of the authors just from my long history of speaking at conferences. So it just gives me, even though I haven't attended this particular event before, I have a lot of confidence, and they've been, just everything's been very tight, which isn't always the case with writing conferences. So check that one out. And I think they have chapters all around the world, if I'm not mistaken. So see if you have a local chapter near you. And that's my number one suggestion.
Yeah, awesome.
Perfect.
All right, Cindy has one more question for you before we get to our final question.
Yeah, this is coming actually, Jane, from a friend of mine who was in a Straight Incorporated, like I was. So he's interested in writing memoir. He would be interested to know your take on how much is too much in memoir, for instance. Is there too personal, or is there too gritty? If he either did or experienced very intense and painful stuff.
It's all about the context and the story that you're trying to tell. But you don't have to tell it all. There's a lot that you can leave up to the reader to infer or to imagine. And sometimes it's more powerful to leave some of the things off the page and just let the reader fill in the gaps or connect the dots. There's a really good interview that just went up maybe a week ago at Vanity Fair with Roxane Gay and Monica Lewinsky, where they're talking about this issue. How much detail do you get into? How personal do you get? When you're writing about any kind of trauma, how much do you show? And it's, you know, there's not any correct answer, but whatever you're sharing or telling needs to serve the story. So I don't know if your friend has some distance from whatever these events are, but I find that distance often helps in deciding which details belong and which don't. I don't know that there's a line that gets crossed, but there is, I think, a limit for the reader in how much they need to know, like especially in the internal monologue or how you felt. So this is where the show don't tell cliche comes, you know, really strongly into making a great story.
Yeah.
You can show what you did, how you behaved, how you reacted. You don't necessarily have to give your own description of how you felt. I think you can definitely let the reader decide how you must have felt given what you did and what happened after.
Nice. Beautiful. All great. Right. And of course you have the perfect article to refer to from recently. I love it. I don't know what you are, but it's genius.
All right. So final questions, question I ask every guest on the show. What is the most important book you've ever read and why, with you defining important however you would like to?
I would say it was a book I randomly pulled off the shelf of a Half Price Books in 1998 in Cincinnati.
I'm loving everything so far.
The title was On Love. I didn't recognize who the author was. It was a very brief novel by Alain de Botton, who's a British author. I think at that time, I don't know if anyone in the US knew him, but he was unknown to me. He's much more popular in the UK. And there was just something, it was a very small square hardcover. It didn't look like a novel. And all of the paragraphs were numbered. And it had a little diagram of an airplane at the beginning. And the setup was, you know, I kind of randomly met this girl on a plane, and it was very philosophical from the very start. And so I ended up buying it and I read it and fell in love with the book. Now there's a chapter in that book titled Romantic Terrorism.
Nice.
Which I recognized myself in. And in the book, he talks about mature and immature forms of love. And it made me realize how much I had wrong about relationships up until that point in my life. And I was young, like I was 23, somewhere in that ballpark. Mm-hmm. And so I was in a serious relationship, but I knew nothing. And so that book was just kind of an introduction to how much I didn't know. And interestingly, Alain de Botton, I ended up following him and reading his other books. Most of his books are nonfiction. They're not novels. But he came out with a novel, his second novel, fairly recently, maybe 3 years ago. And it's basically, I haven't read it, actually, I have to confess. But I read the reviews. I listened to the interviews he gave. And it feels like he rewrote that novel. from the vantage point of being older. And I don't, he had one of the most popular articles in the New York Times. Was the year that book came out. I think he wrote something about, I think it was titled Why You Will Fail at Marriage.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
And I recommend it for everyone, whether you have marriage difficulties or not.
Oh, interesting.
Wow. Okay.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Okay. I can't text his name to myself because I have no idea what you just said, but yeah. I can text to myself why you will fail at marriage.
Yeah. His last name is spelled DeBotton. It's two words, DeBotton. He's marvelous. He has lots of YouTube videos that are very entertaining. He runs something called the School of Life. I can't recommend him enough. Whatever ails you, he's probably figured it out.
So interesting. I'm going to check that out. I love asking this question because you always get like really interesting answers or stories behind it. Mary posted his name in the comments. I mean, in the chat, if anyone wants to get it.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Awesome. So Ebony said, Jane, thanks for not making the question look so painful. Ebony always comments on the faces people make when I ask that question. that was great. All right. So Jane, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was great chatting with you. I had a great time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. And Zelda says hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I've been loving watching his or her tail like flopping around. Yeah.
It's great. So we're just gonna finish. Me and Cindy are just gonna finish up a couple of things, and then but we're gonna say goodbye to Jane now. So thank you so much.
Bye, Jane. Bye. Love you.
All right, that was fun, wasn't it fun?
She's so awesome.
Yeah. All right, so it's time for our audiobook of the week. I just finished this book last night. And I think I made the graphic a little too big, but we'll see how that looks. Oh, that's fine.
It looks good.
Yeah. So it's The X-Talk by Rachel Lynn Solomon, narrated by Emily Ellett. And it is about two coworkers who have quite a bit of tension between them at work. They work at an NPR station in Seattle. And they come up with this idea for a show where it's like two exes giving relationship advice and talking about relationships and that kind of thing. The only problem is they're not actually exes. They're pretending to be. And then, of mm-hmm. course, since it's a romance novel, they start falling for each other. Mm. Surprise.
Love it. NPR. Imagine.
Yeah, it was so cute. I really enjoyed it. But then also the other part of it is, I don't know how many people know this about me, but the person I'm currently dating, I actually started falling for him during a radio interview.
Oh.
So, yeah.
That's perfect.
It was fun. Yeah, and it's they syndicate as a podcast, and I'm a huge podcast fan, so I really enjoyed that aspect of it, and it's just really cute, and the sex scenes are like really hot too. So
bonus.
Yeah,
I'll stick with bonus. Okay, bad, really bad. I told you I'm gonna bring the yuck.
Yeah, it's fun.
Awesome.
So, Cindy, we actually had a question for you from the Patreon question thread. So I'm going to go ahead and ask you the question. Lodestar said, I saw you do life coaching for adults too. Have you ever thought to make an adult version of How to Make Boys Notice You for us?
Wow. That's great. Okay. So if I'm coaching an adult, the question is, how do you make boys notice you? Or is the question, have I ever thought about doing that? Because I can kind of put it together right now. Lodestar, what do you think?
That sounds good to me. Do it.
Okay. So I think the way to make boys notice you. So it sounds like Lodestar like read my little blog for teenagers about how to make people at school notice you. So this is the adult version. And really, here's the thing. When it, for whatever reason, it seems to be catnip for people when you A, notice them and give them some legit attention. Like if you can notice what someone takes pride in, whether that's sneakers or a manicure or like a tight line on their hair, or I don't know what kind of beer they're drinking. If you can notice that thing and appreciate it in a genuine way and then become unavailable. Like, oh, you like that beer? Nobody likes that beer. That's hot. Oh, my phone's ringing. Gotta go. Bye. And kind of loiter over there. So that 1-2 punch of hit them with some, you're special. I see you. And then go away. So it's that push and pull is really, really attractive mm-hmm. to people. And it's the same for young people and for old people. Like people really don't mature beyond 13, do they ever? Or maybe it's just me. That's a great question.
Awesome. Yeah. Or you could start a radio show and interview them because it worked for me.
I mean, what's hotter than that?
All right. So we're going to talk about the viewer poll now. Have you participated in a Twitter book pitch event? And I do want to say before I show the results, obviously, this poll took place on Twitter, so the results are skewed to Twitter users. But here we go. I'm going to click over so I can actually read it. About 48% said yes. 17% said maybe once or twice. 27% said they haven't, but they probably maybe will in the future. And then about 8% said no, and they probably won't do it in the future. But also I didn't make the connection until after I posted it. Like a lot of people follow me because of Pitch Wars, mm-hmm. which is created Pit Mad. Brenda Drake is the creator of both of those. And so I think especially the fact that it's on my Twitter, it's like it's skewed, you know, quite a bit.
Yeah.
So
one of your respondents though said it was because of Pitch Wars or Pit Mad that I got my agent. I was like, that's
DV Pet. Cool. Yeah. DV Pet.
Yeah.
Which is like Pitman, but it's only for marginalized creators.
Aha. Yeah. Nice.
So I participated in Pitmad, and I'm just gonna play the like old card here. Like I participated in Pitmad when we only had 140 characters to pitch, and the hashtag, which was Pitch Madness. So the hashtag was like much longer and we had less space, and I still pitched then. So
you pitched uphill both ways in the snow, like with
exactly,
a crutch.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Oh, so Jane said, by the way, the piece, the title that she said was wrong, it's actually Why You Will Marry the Wrong Person.
Oh, yeah.
So there you can Google that.
Important.
Yeah. All right. So that is pretty much everything. Cindy, thank you so much for coming on. You're a great co-host. Do you have a podcast or anything?
I don't have a podcast, but I have I write on Medium. Yeah. You know,
you have a great voice and you're a great interviewer. So I would listen to a podcast if you did.
Thank you. I've been asked that. It's sort of like, where am I going to find the time? I mean, maybe get 4 hours of sleep instead of five, but.
And before we say goodbye to you, why don't you tell us a little bit about your book?
Cool. Okay. So there's actually two books. They are young adult memoir. Both of them have won awards. The first one is about really kind of my psycho childhood that led up to my running away at age 13, getting arrested by my mother had me arrested for running away at 13. And then I was locked up in this private prison for kids that was eventually investigated, sued, and closed down for being just an absolute torture chamber. So it's been called a concentration camp for throwaway teens. And it happened in the US and people don't know about it. The place was called Straight Incorporated. So if you want to be up all night, Google Straight Incorporated, you won't sleep. My first book, The Dead Inside, is about that. The second book is about getting out of Straight, which was a cult, and going back to my high school at age 15 as an incredibly broken kid, and how really my high school English teacher, she saw something in my writing and she kept me from committing suicide because she saw something in my writing. And it's also about all the ways that I dealt with the pain and just the pain and torture of my childhood, like all the stuff that teen girls go through. Yeah. Those are my two books.
Wow. Sound great.
Yeah. The second book, by the way, is We Can't Be Friends. Yeah. That.
Everyone agrees with me about the podcast, by the way. Lodestar said, I devote to it. Savannah would listen 100%. Yeah.
So. Oh my gosh. Thank you. Thank you guys. Thank you. I'll put it on my list. I have thought about it a lot. Yeah.
Just add another thing on. How hard could it be? Yeah.
What the heck?
Awesome. All right. Cindy, thank you so much. I will talk to you after the show. And I'm going to just close out with a couple announcements. All right.
Okay, cool. Bye. Thanks so much, you guys.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. If you are watching the replay, thank you for watching the replay. And if you're listening to the podcast version, I appreciate it however you consume the show. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to like and subscribe right down there so you don't miss another episode. Or if you're listening on a podcast, leave a review on the podcast platform that you're listening on and tell your friends. If you want to subscribe via email, there's a link in the description for that. And there's also a link for the Patreon if you want to support the show on Patreon. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. You're going to see their names at the end. And I just really appreciate them. And sometimes, like this week was a really tough week. And having you all there and having your support means so much to me whenever I I'm struggling and getting everything ready for the show. So the social media and the website for both of our guests is in the description. So go and check them out and follow them on social media. Upcoming, we have the Wednesday write-ins are continuing every Wednesday at 8 p.m. with Bess Karnan, 8 p.m. Eastern. And those are just, if you need to get some writing done, we'll be there and we'll keep you company. Agent Chat Live is happening again with Amanda Orozco at Transatlantic Agency on March 6th. So next Saturday, I think it's 4 p.m., but don't quote me on that. And the next Pub Talk Live in 2 weeks on March 13th, I'm going to have special guest Stacy Whitman, who is a publisher. So super excited for that conversation. I think that's everyone. Everyone stay safe. Wash your hands, wear a mask. And Jay, thank you so much. Jay said, if you're watching, don't forget a thumbs up. Thank you so much, Jay. Everyone stay safe. Wash your hands, wear a mask, and we'll see you next time. And have a great rest of your weekend, everyone.